factors that go into that decision. We would go back and evaluate the team and the situations, and of course it's going to be driven by whatever, you know, the reasons were that kicked us out of the launch in the first place, and whether we can get the vehicle turned around fast enough, and all of those things would fold into the equation and that we would look at to determine whether it was feasible or not to make that third attempt in a row.
Endeavour carries equipment needed to expand the number of people that can live and work full-time on the International Space Station. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
The Russian Navy says one of its ships, along with a British ship, has broken up a pirate attack off the coast of Somalia. Pirates fired on a Danish ship in the Gulf of Aden off the Somalian coast and then tried to hijack it twice. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Planned Parenthood of Illinois, whose mission is to provide quality, affordable sexual health care. Planned Parenthood is a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll deduction at work. On the web at cs-il.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates. RE/MAX Realty Associates are full-time agents with an average of 13 years professional experience listing and selling homes. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, he's at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about an issue certainly we have discussed before, and this is something that will be one of the major issues that will confront the new president and the new Congress, and that is climate change. And our guest for the program here is Peter Frumhoff. He is Director of Science and Policy, also chief scientist for the climate campaign at the Union of Concerned Scientists, based in Washington, D.C. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to talk about climate change and policy to deal with climate change. His visit here is sponsored by the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, and he'll be speaking as part of a colloquium this afternoon talking about climate science, the work of his organization, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and how we will be dealing with this issue now and in the near future. So questions certainly are quite welcome here on the program. He is a global change ecologist. He's published and lectured widely on topics that include climate change impacts, climate science and policy. He is the lead author, a lead author, of the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has a Ph.D. in ecology and master's degree in zoology from University of California, Davis. And we're very pleased to have him here with us this morning. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Excuse me. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. We want to just encourage people to try to be brief in their questions, but of course, we take as many as we possibly can. Well, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure to be here.
For being here. I'm not exactly sure where we might want to start. Perhaps just with this, it seems to me that what I think we'd like to do, and what I'm sure you would like to do, is focus on what do we do about climate change. But at the same time, it seems that there still seems to be some debate, or at least there are some people who want to debate climate change. Is it happening? How much has the global climate warmed, and to what extent do we say that this is the result of human activity, and to what extent might it be some part of some natural cycle that would be going on whether or not we were dumping a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere or not?
Well, as you know, there may be a debate still in some quarters in the United States, but within the scientific community, there's no serious debate. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I was privileged to be a part, made very clear that the warming that we're seeing to date is unequivocal, that we have a greater than 90% certainty that it's being driven largely by our emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. We know that those emissions are growing more rapidly than had been projected at a global scale even just 10 years ago. We're continuing to see them rise as we emit carbon dioxide from our smokestacks and our power plants and our tailpipes. Mm-hmm. And we know that the impacts of those changes will be considerable if we don't take serious action. The city of Chicago, for example, released a study, a collaboration with a team of top scientists, including several here at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, in which they looked at the projections for extreme heat in the city of Chicago over the course of this century. Today, in an average summer here in Chicago, in the Chicago area, we get about 2 days a summer over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in an average summer. By the end of the century, within the lifetime of our kids and grandkids, if we continue on the path we're on, we project that Chicago will have over a month, a summer over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, essentially the entire summer over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, extreme heat that we can't afford, that will have dramatic impacts on our public health. And that's just one of a range of impacts that will happen here in the Midwest. But the good news is that those aren't inevitable, that we can make choices today in terms of the path of our emissions and reducing our emissions that will leave us a safe and stable climate for future generations. The best available science tells us that should be on the order of about 80% reductions in emissions by mid-century. I'm very pleased that President-elect Obama has put that forward as his target as well.
One of the things that I did, I was taking a look at some of the information that's on your website, the Union of Concerned Scientists website, talking about what we can do to deal with the issue. And that there are a number of things, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of these things. And there was a basic list that had to do with cars and their emissions and the country's electricity system and energy efficiency and so forth. So I'm looking at this, and I scroll down to the bottom, and I see it says when this information was last updated was 4 years ago. Now, I don't mention that as a criticism of your updating your website. I mention that because it says to me, we know today we got some pretty good ideas what we can be doing with this. We knew those things 4 years ago and probably, maybe even longer than that. So the question is, what has held us back? Why is it that we weren't doing these things last year or the year before that or the year before that?
Well, it's hard work. It's a big change in the way in which we power our economy. We are seeing, I think, it's important to note the progress we are making. We now have 28 states in this country that have established what are called renewable electricity standards, where the state is requiring over the course of the next couple of decades to get an increasing fraction of their electricity from renewable sources, from wind and solar, other renewable sources. Just last week in the national election, Missouri passed a ballot initiative that adds that state to the list of states. Illinois is one of the states that has a strong renewable electricity standard. Several states are poised to regulate carbon dioxide emissions from tailpipes, following on California. They're poised to do it. They haven't been able to do it because the Bush administration hasn't, as a sort of formal process by which the Environmental Protection Agency has to grant a formal waiver that allows them, California in particular, to take the lead in regulating these. And the administration has not allowed that to happen. We will see a change. President-elect Obama has made that a priority to allow that waiver to take place so that we can begin to see real regulation of emissions from tailpipes. But again, we've seen other progress. Last year, nationally, we passed the first increase in fuel economy standards in the nation. These take a while to kick in, because require a transformation of our fleet to be more efficient and for people to buy the cars that are more efficient. And so it's going to take a while. But we really need, most importantly, a strong signal from our national government, from our leaders, that this is an issue at our collective top priority. And I think we'll see that shortly.
Yeah. Well, as you say, right now we have a tremendous number of vehicles on the road that have internal combustion engines that are burning gasoline. Now, we're looking at trying to develop other ways of powering personal transportation and mass transportation. And I don't know how long it would be before we actually had something that was really viable, and then how long after that before we could get a kind of a turnover in the fleet so that we would get substantial numbers of other kinds of power plants in the vehicles. But, assuming that we just had to stay with the internal combustion engine, essentially we know for a while, how much more efficient could it be made, or how much do you think that we could reduce emissions from the tailpipe by essentially fine-tuning the technology that we're using now?
Well, there are a variety of ways in which we can reduce our emissions from vehicles. Our vehicle technology experts at the Union of Concerned Scientists tell us that we can dramatically increase fuel economy without any loss in performance, not only from cars but from SUVs. We've been held back not by technology but by the lack of political will to pass standards. Now, I'm pleased that the president-elect, in discussions over bailing out the U.S. auto industry, for example, is putting forward proposals to ensure that any bailout gets accompanied by requirements that that money is used to move towards a more fuel-efficient production of cars that people want to buy. So we're not being held back dramatically as much by technology on that front as we are by political will. There's a lot to be done to sort out what the best available low-carbon fuels are. I know there's a lot of interest here in Illinois on corn-based ethanol. There are some challenges to the science of ensuring that we're actually getting real carbon reductions associated with whatever alternatives we use. And again, there's a need for research and development. There are a number of promising avenues that we can explore for the next generation of biofuels. But that requires policies and financing, R&D investments at a national level. I think we're poised to see that.
Yeah. Well, I know that there are people who want to advocate for either electric cars, for example, or there are a lot of people who think that fuel cells, hydrogen fuel cells particularly, is the kind of thing that the way that we should go. It seems, though, that there's some way to go in developing those technologies, first of all, just to making it work. But do you think that either of those things are really viable and we could see that at some point in some reasonable time frame implemented on a large scale?
Well, I think that we can certainly expand the potential for plug-in electric vehicles, as well as look at alternatives for fuel for conventional and internal combustion engines. At the moment, it's not either or, but really both and. And we need to push on multiple fronts and let the market help decide what the best approaches are. But we can begin those transitions today. You know, people are beginning, notwithstanding the current drop in oil prices, to look for more fuel-efficient cars. And it partly driven by the market, partly driven by prices, and partly driven by our understanding that these are choices we need to make for the collective good with respect to reducing emissions. We're beginning to see interest in that. And this is really where, frankly, the investment, and it will take a while, but the investment in a clean energy and clean vehicles future in this country is really also an investment in jobs. Mm-hmm. And growing our economy out of the recession that we're now in.
Well, we already have a very significant demand and growing demand for electricity in this country. Have you thought about, or has anyone sat down and thought about, if we indeed had more cars where people were plugging them in, either plug-in hybrids or cars that were all electric, they were battery powered, what might that do to the demand for electricity? And then the question of how is we make that demand?
Well, the demand for electricity is a problem depending on where the electricity comes from. Clearly, when we're generating electricity from coal plants, as we are primarily today, and that coal is going to the atmosphere in the form of combusted carbon dioxide, we're not doing any favors to the environment. We need to get off of coal as our primary form of at least coal in its current form. As it's currently produced for powering and creating electricity. There are a range of different opportunities to do that. Again, because of these renewable energy standards and for other reasons, we're seeing a dramatic scale-up of wind technology and investment in this country, including – and the wind potential here in Illinois and elsewhere in the Midwest is quite large. We're seeing we need to invest in research and development to figure out whether we can capture the carbon dioxide that comes from coal and store it underground. Can we create – coal as a viable carbon-free energy source in the future? We don't have the answer to that yet. But we clearly need to take the actions we can take today in terms of increasing efficiency, increasing access to renewables that are currently ready, including wind, and invest in the R&D in technologies of the future so that we can move ourselves onto the path of deep reductions that we truly need.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Peter Frumhoff. He's Director of Science and Policy and also Chief Scientist with the Climate Campaign at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And questions are welcome. He's here visiting the campus, a visit sponsored by the folks at the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. He's here to talk about climate change and policy and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think I said before that you were in Washington, and actually you're in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
That's correct.
That's right. Okay. All right, I'm going to get you in the right place. Glad to have him here, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and let's talk with some callers. We have someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, my name is Bridget, and I was told at a pretty young age when I was in high school, I'm 21 now, that bovine are actually a pretty high producer of greenhouse gases, like in the top three or something like that. And I was just wondering if that was true and if there's anything being done or addressed about that.
Well, Bridget, thank you for your question. Yeah, methane from cattle and sheep are a significant contribution to our emissions, not nearly as large in total as our carbon dioxide emissions, but methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, about 20 times as powerful per molecule as carbon dioxide, so it matters. And people are looking into a range of changes in diet and other approaches to reduce methane production from cattle. I don't know exactly where that R&D stands today. Of course, we can also make choices, dietary choices, to reduce meat consumption and the production of cattle in this country and elsewhere. Those are hard choices for us to make as a society. But eating lower on the food chain is certainly another way to reduce that methane production as well. But it is certainly a problem. It is not the most significant, but as Bill McKibben, the author, likes to say, when it comes to global warming, there's not going to be a silver bullet. There's a lot of silver buckshot, and we need to find every possible opportunity to reduce emissions from all sources.
Okay, well, thank you for answering my question.
All right, let's go to another caller here. Someone in Effingham. This is line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Lately, two things. I saw a blip on BBC in Brazil, and they're big on ethanol there. And the camera panned over to this huge fire, black smoke, and I can't remember if they said it was from the stalks of the sugar cane that they were burning, but it seems surface burning of some waste product in conjunction with the ethanol is happening. Do you know anything about that?
Well, thanks for your question. I don't know the specifics of the example you cite. I can tell you that in general, ethanol produced from sugarcane is better as a substitute for fuel oil than ethanol produced from corn. It has much lower emissions associated with production than does corn-based ethanol.
The other thing is China, whom I've heard to build a new coal-fired electrical plant every week.
That's correct.
Or some such as that. And they are in their theistic stage of the advancement of capitalism. And if technology doesn't arrive there in time, and they're building then Chinese coal with what I've heard too is more sulfurous or less efficient than what's in the U.S. If that continues to grow and they have a billion people in their population and they're already honing in on big cars, Buicks and Olds and SUVs and all that, they're now a new capitalist class, the outcome of anything, if we went totally pristine, and no emissions, and as Bridget mentioned about animals, you know, which the contribution there, as you said, is enormous as well. But even if we control that, will all our efforts be for nothing? And then the global warming will continue to into the future from another source. Thank you, sir, and I'll hang up.
Well, I appreciate the question. It's a really important issue for us to grapple with. It is certainly true that other nations bear a meaningful responsibility to reduce their emissions as well. By far, the U.S. on a cumulative basis is the largest source of emissions to date of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. China is indeed producing and increasing coal-fired power plants. They are also taking some meaningful steps. Their fuel economy standards, for example, are in line with Europe's, which are far higher than ours. And they get this issue. And many folks who work closely with Chinese experts are pretty clear that China is waiting for U.S. leadership on this issue. China has a – as they grow and as they grow their economy, they still have a per capita emissions that's about a quarter of ours. They do have a lot more people. And we need to help China get on – and other developing nations get onto a path that is a path that we did not take, which is, say, a clean energy path for improving their quality of life and the health and well-being of their people. I think the best way to do that is for the U.S. government to re-engage meaningfully in the international negotiations, which are set up to conclude in December 2009 in Copenhagen to craft the successor to the current phase of the Kyoto Protocol, to the international agreement around which nations as a whole come together to make collective decisions about reducing emissions. Every indication is that China will move quickly to take action on a concerted basis once the U.S. steps up to the table and makes a commitment to reduce our emissions. It's an important political challenge for us to show leadership, as we have in so many other settings over the course of the past many decades. It's very hard for developing countries to take on that kind of leadership when we're not sitting at the table, when our Senate and when our Congress and President have basically said this is not an issue we wish to address. I'm quite hopeful, as President-elect Obama has put reengaging international climate negotiations as well as building a domestic cap on carbon as top priorities, that we'll see as we take those actions that China, India, Brazil, and others will do so as well.
Just to stay with or to talk a little bit more about coal, I think that a lot of people have said, well, we have a very significant resource there if we could figure out how to use it in a way that didn't generate all this – put all this carbon dioxide in the air. And some people have said, well, you know, theoretically it should be possible to take that coal, burn it, capture the CO2, and then somehow inject it into the ground or store it. This is carbon sequestration, and some people have said, well, that actually could work. Has anyone actually demonstrated that, shown, yes, in fact, there is a way that it's possible to do that and that it can work?
Yes, there are a couple of small-scale demonstration projects at a couple of different places in the world. They're not really designed to be the stepping points to developing this at full scale. And there's a number of issues that need to be addressed. Can we create that storage safely in a way that it won't leak back to the atmosphere? What's the cost of this going to be? So would the technology to do this be cost-effective? And will this be competitive with other non-coal-based sources of energy? We clearly need to invest in significant R&D and demonstration projects at a major scale. We just – the Union Concerned Scientists just produced a report on coal and global warming that folks can get on our website that basically calls for something on the order of 10 to 15 investments in the United States of 10 to 15 demonstration projects at the nearest opportunity to ensure that we can understand this technology, what it takes to build it, to create the infrastructure, to get the emissions down into the ground, and to really test drive this so we actually can answer the question you just asked. Until we do that, in our view, we should not be building new coal plants absent this technology, and we should not be investing at this at the expense of other electricity renewable sources that we know are also feasible and viable and socially sustainable today.
And are there any other good technologies available other than capturing the carbon and sticking it somewhere, anything that else that you can do with chemistry or any other sort of technique that can be applied to scrub the emissions and to get that CO2 and sulfur dioxide and all those other things that we don't want going into the atmosphere, get them out?
Well, there are a variety of approaches people can take. We can make those coal plants more efficient through what's called coal gasification technology so that we can increase the efficiency of plants and produce less carbon dioxide per unit coal that's burned. But we would really need to develop this technology to capture that carbon dioxide and store it underground at a massive scale if we're going to be able to make coal a viable technology for the future.
Okay. We have some other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Villa Grove, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about biofuels, like from whenever you get them from the grease fryer, and then they take them and they can turn them into diesel for a van or truck or anything like that. I was wondering if that puts out less emissions, and if so, how easy would it be for like some place in Champaign Urbana to get the fuels from the restaurants that they have there?
You know, I know people are experimenting with that. It's just not a technology that I'm deeply familiar with, so I can't answer the specifics of your question about how, you know, what the potential to scale this up is. I know people are doing this in a variety of ways, mostly in small scale settings. What its potential is to be a significant biofuel source is something that I really can't comment on.
Okay, then. Okay, well, thank you anyway.
Okay. Well, let's go on to another caller, Belgium, not that far away. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to address the situation that you brought up earlier about methane. Now, methane is a much stronger global warming gas, greenhouse gas, than carbon dioxide, and it exists all over the world. It exists as a hydrate in the ocean. It exists trapped in the permafrost. Now, the warming of the Arctic areas where most of the permafrost is releases this gas, which then makes it warmer. So it's a circular type situation. So once we get to a certain point, we're going to be generating methane gas no matter what we do. As long as it warms up, it's going to be released into the atmosphere and going to cause more warming. How do you propose to get around that problem?
Well, what you raise is a really significant issue. It's one of the cases of threshold effects where we may begin to see what, you know, colloquially we might call tipping points of change where you get positive feedback effects. This is certainly one, and there's a lot of concern about it. We don't know really how much warming, you know, we don't know precisely what that point would be. We're beginning to see, there's been evidence over the past several months, you may have seen in some news reports about increased methane being produced from the ocean seafloor, shallow seafloors in the Arctic Ocean. We don't know if that's part of a directional trend that will continue. We don't know to what extent that's being caused by global warming per se. And we don't know at what scale it's increasing emissions and therefore warming. There's a lot of science yet to be done on this. We do know that potentially within temperatures that we may reach this century, we may get to that tipping point where we'll have positive continued production of methane from permafrost and hydrates, as you identify, in a way that would be disastrous. Just as we may also reach tipping points with the deglaciation of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, which would produce over the course of centuries sea level rise on the order of 20 or more feet. And these are really serious issues. The best way we can avoid them is to move towards a path of swift and deep reductions in the emissions that we can control today here in the United States and internationally, and to keep us below temperatures below those levels that would cause this to take place.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Right,
thank you. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. We have a couple of other callers we'll get right to, but for anyone who might just have tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Dr. Peter Frumhoff. He is with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's director of science and policy. He's also chief scientist with their climate campaign. He's a global change ecologist. He has published and lectured widely on topics that include climate change impacts, climate science and policy, tropical forest conservation and management, and biological diversity. He's a lead author of the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a colloquium talking about climate change in the U.S., science, political will, and public policy. His visit here sponsored by the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll continue, and our next caller is in Champaign and on line number three.
Hello. Could you announce where and when your guest is speaking, because I think the public ought to know. You announced, but you didn't give it a place.
I can do that, and I'm assuming that anybody who is interested in stopping by, this seminar is taking place this afternoon in room 144 of the Loomis Lab on the U of I campus, and that's at 3:30.
Okay. And I have a question. Could you say something about the well, health aspects of coal. Every time I see an electric car, I think of the people who have to dig the coal in the Four Corners and perhaps have a 45-year-old lifespan and like lung disease and things like that. And I wonder if that's a very minor question because everything is mechanical, or whether that's part of the issue. We have a clean air in our backyard, but it's dirty somewhere else.
No, it's a really important question. You know, there's a lot of talk about clean coal as a catchphrase, which usually implies the carbon capture and storage technology we've been discussing. But that only looks at the emissions from the smokestack, which is an important issue, but not the only issue. You've got to look at the impacts, both environmental and public health, on the extraction of coal. In addition to the specific public health issues that you raised, of course, a great deal of coal still gets produced in the Appalachians and in West Virginia by mountaintop removal mining, which by no reasonable means can be considered clean. And so we really need to, if we're going to, in my view, continue to rely on coal as a as an energy source, we need to clean it up in a real sense to deal with all areas of the life cycle and ensure that we're not putting public health, natural ecosystems, and our atmosphere at risk. So, no, it's by no means a minor issue, but it does get swept under the rug, frankly, in the hopeful and important discussions about carbon capture and storage.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll go next to – this is someone here in Champaign County where we are on a cell phone, so get them. And this is line number two. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
This may have been asked already, but can you tell me then, would you be in favor or should we do this FutureGen project in Mattoon and maybe comment on that technology, that project, and I'll ring off and listen on the air. Thank
you. Okay, thank you.
Well, I know that the project has been put off the front burner. Maybe that's a nice way of saying it. And I'm honestly not qualified to speak specifically to the strengths of the FutureGen project. I can tell you that we definitely need significant investment in demonstration and R&D projects of the sort that was trying to produce. So that we can really test drive carbon capture and storage technology. Again, I want to emphasize that we can't be doing this. We must not do this at the expense of moving reductions that we have available to us through all the means that we know are available and cost effective today. That is to say, we often look for kind of silver bullets, through efficiency, our cars, our buildings, our electricity sector, through renewables that are available today, we have quite a variety of means to reduce emissions in a meaningful sense and get us on the path to reductions while still exploring other technologies that we may need down the line. Mm.
So you don't know anything one way or another about whether because people there in Mattoon are still hoping that it's possible that the project could get. It could be funded, though you don't have any knowledge one way or another about what might be likely to happen with we have a new president and new Congress on that particular project.
I don't. I would say more generally that Illinois has just become the most politically important state in the nation, and I would say there are a variety of opportunities here at the University of Illinois as the flagship campus in this politically important state and in other settings across the state to take advantage in the best sense of building a clean energy economy here and building the students of the who will help design that economy here in Illinois. I think there'll be a lot of interest, political and otherwise, in moving smart projects forward here in the state.
Uh-huh. Next caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi. I will confess that I read the Wall Street Journal.
It's okay. I don't hold it against you.
I certainly get the impression from many of the things I've read there and elsewhere that there are a lot of quite qualified scientists who are still skeptical and are more inclined to place the blame for climate change on natural cycles. But my main question is, have you read, and if so, what do you think about the arguments made by Bjorn Lomborg in a book that he published recently called Cool It? And then I think it was just last Saturday, there were two articles in the Wall Street Journal, one by a novelist, actually, who's very much of the apocalyptic opinion on this, and the other one by Lomborg, saying that the amount of money that would have to be spent to reduce carbon dioxide by 80% or whatever could much better be spent on things like clean water, AIDS, and so forth.
Well, let me first say that there are, in many respects, two Wall Street journals. There's the there's the news section of the Wall Street Journal, which does a very good job of reporting the science of climate change and the policy debates around climate and energy. And then there's the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, which, in my view, is not the place to go to get a take on credible science. You know, science needs to be based on what's in the peer-reviewed literature, and representations of that peer-reviewed literature in forms from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, from the National Academy of Sciences, from people who have worked and thought and read and published on this issue, careful research for which there really is no serious debate. So I would just encourage you to look to credible sources that are based on the science rather than editorials. As it relates to you know, the point you raise about should we be investing in reducing our emissions or should we be attacking other important health and development issues, you know, it's hard for me to think of that as an either-or proposition. The projections of what climate change will do if unmitigated to water supply, for example, in the Himalayas, which is the source of drinking water for all the major rivers, the six major rivers of India and China, and poised to decline quite rapidly as warming temperatures decrease snowpack in the Himalayas. The potential for development in a sustainable manner in the face of unmitigated climate change is exceptionally limited. And yes, we need, of course, as a society, as we are doing, and as frankly, as the Bush administration has done a very good job of investing in public health issues in Africa and elsewhere. It is simply not consistent with the science to imagine that we can help developing countries and ourselves move onto a sustainable path in the decades ahead with a business as usual. Continued emissions of greenhouse gases. The science is quite clear on that. So I really take issue with the kind of fundamental supposition. I also don't think that reducing emissions is inherently costly. You know, we are we have been constrained by an auto industry in this country that has been resistant to producing fuel efficient cars, while Toyota and Honda have, you know, laughed all the way to the bank by producing cars that are more fuel efficient and that people want to buy. It is really the energy economy of the future that we need to build and that will power us out of the recession that we're in today. Sure, there will be costs to some industries. The oil industry needs to look very different tomorrow than it does today. But business as usual is not consistent with maintaining economic development and sustainable development here and abroad in the decades ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Just a quick question for those people who advocate that we ought to be doing everything we can to develop renewables, solar, wind, and hydro, so forth. What do you think is the most that we could expect them to provide, what their contribution would be to the total energy mix, you know, as a source of energy?
Well, let's say we need to reduce our emissions by 30% or so below current levels over the next couple of decades. That's sort of the path we need to be on to get to a 80% reduction by mid-century here in the U.S., consistent with deep and swift reductions in other nations. We're actually just completing an analysis that will be out in the spring that looks explicitly at that question. People, surprisingly, have not done really careful integrated analyses to say what's the fraction of reductions you can achieve from renewables efficiency and at what cost relative to other sources. We think, based on preliminary results, we can get most of the way there over the course of the next couple of decades with meaningful investment in wind and solar, hydro, geothermal, and scaled up energy efficiency, which we know is really the largest untapped source of decreased emissions that we have. But I can't give you a quantitative number because I don't think the analyses have been done at the scale that we need, which is exactly why we clearly need to take seriously R&D in other technologies. Also because as the science progresses, you know, since over the past several years, the science of climate change has only gone in one direction, which is to say greater risk at lower increased temperature than we thought just a decade ago. Mm-hmm. We don't know where it's going to be in a decade ahead, but we need to kind of have all of our resources available to move us as quickly as possible to a clean energy future.
Just one other thing, and this was I read an article about this that was just recently in the New York Times, and it was concerning the fact that some kind of electric industry group, and my apologies, I don't recall who it was, but essentially the bottom line was they were about to issue a report that said that if we went very heavily towards developing solar and wind as sources of electricity, that the grid, the transmission grid that we'd use to get the power from wherever it's generated to wherever it's needed, would not be up to it. And certainly there has been quite a bit on and off in the past few years about the problems of the deteriorating condition of the transmission grid. And this was just one more aspect of infrastructure in this country that we've neglected and we need to do something about.
Absolutely. You know, as a nation, we built the rail system. As a major a grid that now transports is 40% of rail is now for transporting coal. In this country, we built the interstate highway system. We made public investments in critical infrastructure to support economic development in this nation. We clearly need a national investment in the infrastructure to move wind energy, for example, from the rural areas in which it's mostly going to be available to produce, including in rural areas here in the Midwest, to urban centers on the coast and elsewhere. And that's going to require a significant investment. There are a lot of smart ways to do it, but it's going to take a national strategy. I would say, for example, that the Department of Energy, going back to your earlier question, has looked hard at the wind potential here in this country and has come up with a quite conservative estimate that 20% of our electricity can be gotten from wind over the next couple of decades, including from major investments here in Illinois. President Obama, President-elect Obama, has proposed 25% renewable energy by 2025. Others, including former Vice President Gore, have put forward quite ambitious proposals over the next decade. I think the goal is to the issue is as a nation we need to set some meaningful goals as we did to put a man on the moon and really work towards achieving them. At the moment, we don't have a national goal. Mm. And that's what we need.
I'm assuming, and I'm not sure what the figure would be, but I'm assuming that electricity is actually lost along as it moves from the place where it's produced to the place where it's used.
Sure.
So the metaphor is the equivalent of having leaks in your pipes, that little bits of it get – if that's true, how much electricity do we just throw away because it gets lost in the transmission?
You know, I don't have the numbers on that, but it is true. It's a significant challenge. But there are, again, technologies available to, if you think it's, it's smart ways to establish transmission lines that will reduce leakage. We face some challenges in developing this, but again, we've got to put the best minds to work and make this happen.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, with our guest, Dr. Peter Frumhoff. He's Director of Science and Policy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're talking about policy and global climate change and what we need to do about it. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Up next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign and on line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to the issue of carbon sequestration, please.
Yeah.
Back in the 50s and 60s, we got rid of waste with a sort of a mantra of dilution is the solution. Put it, throw waste in the ocean, and it just go away. And the idea of sequestering carbon dioxide smacks of the same mindset to me. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, it's an interesting a point you make. The fact is that as we've drawn oil, for example, out of the ground, there are a number of geological formations where we think we can, the best science suggests we can inject carbon dioxide in stable forms for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, saline aquifers and other formations. We need to be very careful as we do this that we're not creating unintended consequences, including the potential future re-release of that large that large stored carbon dioxide. We got one planet to deal with. We've got to find a place to put the carbon dioxide if we're going to continue to burn it. We don't have, in some sense, we don't have a lot of storage options available. There are a lot of discussions about different ways in which we can clean up our act, but storage in stable geological formations is a place, in my view, we need to seriously look at. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change took a hard look at this a couple of years ago. Again, the science suggests that there are appropriate ways to do this, but it's not just technology; it's about setting the right policies, about ensuring that we do this in ways that are socially sustainable, as well as technologically feasible. So, I think it needs to be given a serious look. But the verdict is not entirely in yet.
Good, thank you.
All right, thank you to Urbana next, line number three. Hello.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, myself. I wanted to ask you a question about. You referenced models, computer models of climate change, and I've noticed that I've looked at this for years, and I've noticed that the models from the late 90s into the early 2000s are incorrect as to, for instance, the ice-free Arctic during the summer and into the early fall.
Right.
How will they be able to correct these models? Also, is there a way to catalyze the emissions from plants, like a catalytic converter in a car converts the exhaust and basically, this water vapor takes most of sulfur dioxide out, and the only thing comes out basically is water vapor and some CO2 and some minor elements. Is there any way to develop a technology that can do that? But I really want to thank you for your work, because you guys have really, I think you need to be more emphatic about how dangerous this could be coming, because they were talking about ice-free Arctic in 2020. We're having it now.
That's
right. How much worse can it get? In the model, as the models are obviously incorrect. Thank you very much. I'll take your answer off here.
Well, thank you. I can answer your question about the models more so than I can about the technology question that you raised. And let me just say a few words about it. The models have improved a great deal from the decade ago that you cited, for a number of reasons that probably go into more detail than we need to discuss here. But the potential for these massive global climate models to project backwards and basically look at the historic record and therefore give us some sense of their validation for how well they can project forward has improved a great deal for a variety of reasons. But there are many things that they don't do terribly well. And what they really don't do terribly well, which really gets to your point, is look at and be able to predict some of the non-gradual changes that we might see, for the kind of surprises, if you will, that are kind of the known unknowns, if you will, that the ones that we know we need to be worried about, but we don't have a good handle on how to model them. Just as an example of that, as some of you may know, we've been seeing much faster than the global climate models have projected rapid deglaciation and movement of the ice sheets, particularly in Greenland, as we've also seen declines in the polar ice cap. Greenland is a very serious issue. This is land-based ice, lots of water in that land-based ice. And as the ice sheet is opening up, we're seeing that rate potentially accelerate, in part because the water that's now flowing from the surface down into the crevices below are lubricating the ice at the bedrock and causing it to move more quickly. You then get a dark surface exposed, which is more absorptive of the heat than the light surface of the ice, which causes a positive reinforcement and potentially can cause that melting to happen more quickly. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had quite conservative projections of sea level rise, in part because the models can't model this very carefully. We know it's a serious risk, but we don't know how to evaluate it. So what we tend to do as scientists is provide the most conservative assessments rather than go out on a limb and say, here's the worst case scenario. That's the nature of science. And we do need, I agree with you, to really highlight that the risks may be greater than our science can currently tell us.
Try to get one more caller in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You touched on transportation, but it seems to me that railroading is so much more efficient than a 2 mile per gallon garbage truck, and that's taking some of the semi-traffic off the road. Is there policy, will there be policies that will encourage the railroads to re-railroad and put in hubs and move things in a intermodal fashion, with different technology and more efficiency in terms of use of fuel?
You know, I don't know the answer. It's a really good question. Clearly, in Europe and Japan, we have far more widely used and more efficient rail systems than we do here in the United States. I simply don't know what's on the table. And especially, of course, as we are going to face hard choices about where to invest as a nation in a in such a challenging economic time that we're in, I frankly don't know whether revamping our rail system is seriously on the table.
Just a quick, and we have about a minute. We talked earlier, and people have raised questions about the cost of trying to deal with global warming. Other people have said, well, there's actually great potential here for revitalizing and actually building a new kind of green economy by moving in that direction. Any thought on what actually could, what in terms of economic benefits could be generated?
Well, there have been a number of studies, and I'd direct your readers to research on our website that look at the economic potential for jobs to be created from the renewable energy industry in particular. I would just highlight that often when we talk about cost, we're not including what the cost of inaction are. There are enormous costs of inaction on our water supply, on our public health, on our agricultural systems, on our lands, that most assessments of economics don't include. We've been now working with scientists and economists across the nation, including several here at the university, to help bring a single voice together and help make clear that that when we think about costs, we need to ensure that the costs of climate change are frankly embedded in it, and make that clear to policymakers. I would say that I hope we're going to see from the next administration an economic stimulus that includes a focus on clean energy investment and really building the economy of the future. If we're going to be competitive with other nations who are currently putting a lot of time and energy into investing in wind and other renewables, to developing cars that are more fuel efficient, we're going to grow ourselves out of a recession by having the kinds of technologies and policies and industries that can be viable in a carbon-constrained world. That's the world we're going into, that we need to go into, and those who are at the front end of that will benefit economically.
Our guest, Dr. Peter Frumhoff, is Director of Science and Policy and Chief Scientist of the Climate Campaign for the Union of Concerned Scientists. If you're interested in finding out more about the group, looking at the information that has to do with climate change and other things, just go to their website. He's here visiting, taking part in a symposium talking about climate change and how to confront that in terms of political will and public policy. His visit here is sponsored by the folks in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Focus 580, this program made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers 4 area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. That's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, we'll talk about weathering the economic downturn. Our guest will be journalist John Wagoner. He covers the personal finance beat for USA Today. His latest book, Bailout, is an examination of what happened to Bear Stearns and the response of the Federal Reserve. John Wagoner will join us at 1:06. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 592. That's up 21. The March contract, 608, up 23 and a quarter. In Chicago, December wheat, 542 and a half, up 19 and a quarter. March, 570, up 26. December corn, 380 and a quarter, up 6. March, 397, up 5 and a quarter. May, 410 and a half, up 6 and 3 quarters. July, 420, up 5. November soybeans, 894, down 14. January, 916, unchanged. March, 910 and a half, down 14. May, 919 and a half, down 14 and 3 quarters. December soybean meal, 273 even, that up 350. December oil, 3295, down 78.